all together. I was always, when collecting material like this, the person who collects it ends up benefiting tenfold over anything they could possibly deliver to anybody else. So one suggestion I have is, if you have time to dig into something, these three chapters are, feels like there's almost a lifetime of learning that can be extracted from them. In terms of where we've come from, we started talking about this contrast between two mountains. Mount Sinai, we have the thunder and the tempest and the fear and the doom. And then Jesus comes to a mountain with a completely different premise, where people come to his feet and listen to a list of blessings rather than a list of prohibitions. But through it all, Jesus really kind of shakes things up on the default way that we tend to think about things. And for instance, he told us that keeping the law is actually not a definitive proof of righteousness. That if you follow the rules, it's no guarantee that that indicates that you are a righteous person. And then we found out that if you love someone, that is also not necessarily guaranteed to be righteous. There's other things to it. And if you're charitable, then that also is not guaranteed to be righteous. And if you pray, that's not guaranteed to make you righteous. And if you are self-sacrificing, or if you fast, none of these things guarantee that you're a righteous person. And so what we find is that detecting righteousness is surprisingly difficult. Okay, we come and we think, oh, we know what righteousness is, and we can see it in ourselves, we can see it in others, and then we go through Jesus' list, and he kind of keeps whittling things down to the point where we go, it's really hard to definitively know if we're dealing with righteousness or unrighteousness. And that's when Jesus brings us to chapter 7. And it seems a fitting introduction. He starts off with, judge not. So he's just spent two chapters saying, righteousness is a whole lot more complicated than you thought it was at the beginning of this. You know, you thought it was thou shalt not kill. That's pretty clear. But I'm taking you to a new level, and in this new level, righteousness is very hard to pin down. And this is one of these absolute challenging statements in these chapters. And we've seen a number of them. You know, do not store up money, for instance. What were some of the other ones? You know, if somebody asks you for your stuff, you're supposed to just give it to them. There's all kinds of these absolute statements in here that we struggle to fully observe. Of course, the biggest one is be perfect. An absolute statement. You must be perfect. But a lot of people love this verse, and they actually stop at the second word, right? And they say, oh, look, it says in the Bible, judge not. And so if you have anything to say about my behavior, you are going contrary to the Bible, right? Now, the almost ironic and amusing thing about that is that that is a form of legalism. That is a form of exactly what Jesus has been fighting throughout all this chapter. The notion that you can just do exactly what it says without considering the consequences. Thou shalt not kill, I'm a righteous person. And people come to this verse and say, judge not, I never judge anybody, I'm a righteous person. And it's actually not that simple, because as we talked about yesterday, motives matter. Why aren't you judging? If you're not judging because you're too scared to put God's opinion out there, that's maybe not the best reason not to be judging. Or if you're not judging that you be not judged, and there's an interesting what that phrase might actually mean, but sometimes we do that as calling a truce with each other, right? Tell you what, I won't judge you, then you don't judge me, and we can both do whatever we want, right? Clearly, that cannot be what Jesus is talking about when he says, judge not, that you be not judged. So we have to make sure that we understand these absolute statements in the greater context. We're talking about a scale of righteousness and how do we become more righteous. And what Jesus, I think, is saying here is that there's a mistaken notion that the more righteous you are, the more likely and the more room you have to judge other people. And he's saying it actually tends to work the other way. The less righteous you are, the quicker you are to judge other people. And as you become more in tune with what righteousness really is, your tendency to judge people is going to start to go down and down and down. We have the story, of course, of the woman caught in adultery. And it says the oldest left first, right? And it was the young ones who were left still going, judge this person, judge this person. And then they finally walked away. So let's just go through this section verse by verse, because it's interesting to take apart. So the next verse is, in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. If we take this approach in our relationship with people around us, we shouldn't be surprised, two things, that other people in our community will take this approach to our behavior, but it's actually not about how other people are going to treat us, because the really important thing is how God is going to treat us, right? And there's a lot of verses that say God's judgment of you is related to your judgment of other people. We have the parable in Matthew 18 of the unforgiving servant, right, where the master forgives a servant a tremendous sum, and then a servant goes out there and refuses to forgive a small sum, and that forgiveness is then revoked from the master. He's like, if you can't forgive people around you small things, then why should I forgive you big things? And in the section on prayer that we kind of skipped yesterday, Jesus goes out of his way to say, if you forgive others, then God will forgive you. But if you don't forgive others, God is not going to forgive you. And by the way, this works the other way as well, where it says in Luke 6:3, give and it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. We can look at it the other way. If we are generous to other people in our assessments, then we will obtain generosity in return. And I brought up this chart yesterday of my tendency to be merciful to other people and how, in relation to the distance since my last mistake. So if I made a mistake an hour ago, I have maximum amount of mercy that I extend to others. And then as time goes by and I forget my errors, my level of mercy declines accordingly. Now, hopefully what has happened as we've looked through all these questions of righteousness is that we'll never get past these first few blocks, right? That we'll be looking at Matthew chapter 5 and 6 and going, well, was I righteous? And we'll keep going, well, not quite. Not quite. Anger, lust, have I kept my word? All these things which it takes a lifetime to try to get better at. And we'll spend all our time here, and hopefully our mercy will stay up there. And the danger of misinterpreting righteousness is that it has consequences, and one of the consequences is we think of ourselves as righteous, and then we start imposing on other people a certain sort of framework of justice, of standing up for certain standards and things like that. Verse 3, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? And there's an irony, and Noah is not here right now, so I can talk about him. On the way home, he was sitting with Micah in the back, and he was saying, oh, hey, Micah, you know how some people, when you're trying to talk to them, they go, no, 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 no. And in the front, we're like, some people do that, Noah? And he's like, yeah, some people do that. And it was like, well, do you mean that you do that? He's like, well, sometimes I do that. But and he moved on. And the fact is, no is one of Noah's favorite words. Like, whenever you say anything, he's like, no, 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 no. And he gets into it. But the interesting thing, even at his age, is that he's aware of it. But what he's done is he's put the importance of it and made it very small, and the occurrences of it very rare. And it turns out that we all do this. Any behavior that might be somehow considered not great, we put it in a bucket and we say, well, the consequences aren't that bad, and I don't do it that often anyway. Okay, it's like studies show this is how we perceive ourselves, but when we perceive other people, we have a very clear picture of how often they really have that behavior and what the consequences really are. And psychologists call it the shadow as well, that there are certain behaviors that follow you around, like you're doing them, and everybody who's looking at you can see you and your shadow. They see both sets of behaviors, but you don't see it. Right? You walk around and there's all these things going on, and it shows up in your life as surprises. Why do people always behave this way? That's weird. And in extreme cases, why do I always lose my job? Why can I never get along with my coworkers? Why are people so frustrating in this respect? And often, there's a shadow. You are bringing something into the mix that you don't realize you're bringing. And it's so hard to have true understanding of who we are. And then we turn around and look at other people and try to, you know, fine-tune their behavior. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? The log is in... This is our perception. This is how we see the world. We trick ourselves into thinking that we have crystal clear vision, but in fact, we don't. And yet we take our blurry vision and apply it to other people around us and expect to have good results. And so the irony of this is, if there was someone in this community who was perfect, we as a community would not consider them perfect, right? Because we would look at them and they'd go, oh, they're kind of fuzzy right over here. Yeah, no, they've got things they can work on. But it's in fact our glasses that are wrong. And we all have wrong glasses. And so it becomes really challenging to know, especially on the finer points, which side of the issue should you be on? Deuteronomy says, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. Fundamental principle of the law, by the mouth of two or three witnesses. Why do you think this is in the law? Anybody? Yeah, I mean, they know this in court now, but a single account is almost certainly untrustworthy, okay? And when you're talking in your head, how many perspectives are you carrying in there, right? You've got one witness in your own head. And the whole premise of the law is one witness is not good enough because they're unreliable, right? That one witness is unreliable. So your story of what's going on in the world around you, your list of facts and observations, is known scripturally to be incorrect, or almost certainly skewed in a certain direction, right? And so you got to bring another, ideally three, right? You get three people, and if the three of you can agree that that's actually what's going on, you know, it actually doesn't guarantee anything. It just increases your odds of coming to a better understanding. Matthew 18 has this, right? If your brother offends thee, go to him privately. Right? So that's one-on-one. But sometimes it turns into a he said, she said. What do? Bring in another person. Because at this point, we have no idea who is looking at the matter in a blurry fashion. Is it the accused or is it the accuser? Could be either way. And I think bringing in that other person is as much for the accused's benefit as for the accuser's perspective. Because half the time when we bring somebody else in and say, can you believe what they did? They'll go, well, did you consider this? Or have you considered that? Or what about this? And all of a sudden, the certainty of our cause starts to drop. And in Matthew 18, it says you got to keep going, right? If you can't resolve it with two or three, then you go, you know, eventually you get the whole ecclesia involved. You got to get as many perspectives as possible. And the root cause is the fundamental understanding that you cannot be trusted. You cannot be trusted to make decisions about other people's lives individually. Hopefully, as a community, we can come to some right decisions. And again, even that doesn't always work, but it gives you the best chance if you collect other input. Verse 5, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. First, right? We talk about seek ye first the kingdom of God. Do this thing first, and the rest will follow. First, remove the plank from your own eye. How we hate to do this, right? Jesus is saying, first, address the problems in your own life. Once you've got your own life figured out, there'll be space there for you to try to help other people. And if we've just read the previous chapters in Matthew, we know that getting this plank out of our own eye is super difficult, right? It's going to consume a tremendous amount of our energy and our focus to get the plank out of our own eye, which means the amount of time we'll have to go around finding other people's specs will hopefully be reduced. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, for they will trample them under feet and turn around and tear you to pieces. I've had a long history of uncertainty with this verse, because I'm like, what really is this verse doing at this point in this chapter? The most common interpretation that I've heard of this verse is, well, don't preach to people who aren't interested. Right? If you go out and you preach in a bar somewhere when everybody's drunk, well, don't be surprised if they turn on you and sort of trample your message underfoot. But that really doesn't fit the context, right? We've been talking about judging, and all of a sudden he says, don't give what is holy to the dogs. And let me see if I switched my slides. First of all, there's a curiosity about this where it says, don't give what is holy to the dogs, don't throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample you underfoot. And presumably it's the swine that trample you underfoot. And turn and tear you to pieces. And it's like, wait a minute, the swine are going to turn and tear you to pieces? And that's kind of confusing. And so it turns out the structure of this verse is what's called an introverted parallelism or something like that. Gotta be careful with my words. But there's an example of this in, well, it's actually all over the Bible if you keep your eye open for it. But this is in James. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. And if you look at the structure of the verse, you actually see it's like an onion. Of God, for God. I am tempted, cannot be tempted. When he is tempted, neither tempteth he, let no man say any man. And if you look through Scripture, you'll find this all over the place. It was here in the previous chapter. No man can serve two masters. Either he hates the one and loves the other, or he's devoted to the one and despises the other. You cannot serve God and money. So if we apply this structure to that verse, then it just tells us that the tearing to pieces is actually about the dogs. So the dog behavior is the bookends, and the swine behavior is the center. And that at least results one little uncertainty for me on how to interpret that passage. But what does it mean to throw, to cast our pearls before swine? And I propose to you that what he's talking about is that don't go throwing your opinion where it actually isn't wanted. Right? So if you've figured that you've fixed the plank in your own eye, and you think you're qualified now to help people work on the specs in their eyes, there's another criteria, which is anybody interested in your opinion on the topic? Right? Because if they're not, don't be surprised if you get a somewhat hostile response. Right? So, like, if you start intruding, and, you know, if you think you've got parenting sorted out enough that you can go tell other parents what they should be doing, don't be surprised if you get bit, right? And now, if somebody is struggling with parenting and comes to you and says, I'd like some help with this, well, that's fantastic, right? That's a great opportunity. But our mandate isn't really to go around poking other people and telling them how to be better when they don't want to hear it. Because consider this, and I didn't put the verse up here, but do not give what is holy to the dogs. And there's an interesting switch here, because what have we been talking about the previous five verses? Judgment. And we've been talking about judgment as in somewhat negative terms. And then in verse 6, he turns around and says, don't give what is holy to the dogs. And it's like he's calling judgment something holy. He's turning the tables on us and says there is something valuable here, but you can't use it in the inappropriate context. Right? There is value to be had in your perspective, in your opinion, but you gotta wait till it's the right time and the right place. And in Proverbs chapter 9, 7 to 8, it says, "He who corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse, and he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you." Okay? There's no point. Don't cast your pearls before swine. "Reprove a wise man, and he will love you." There is a circumstance where you can share information with people in a constructive way, and they will love you for it. Right? But you have to have the wisdom to find that. And wrong slide. The thing I like about this dog and swine verse, though, is it turns it around, and we start to ask ourselves, am I a dog or a swine? What happens, what do I do when people give me feedback? Do I turn around and attack them? Is that the kind of person I want to be with potentially constructive information? But to summarize, we started this section with beware. We talked about the previous chapter starting with beware. And basically Jesus is saying beware of judging. For a number of reasons. We presume more mercy than we give. We expect to receive more mercy than we're willing to extend to other people. We completely underestimate the magnitude of our flaws. You know, I read this book called Being Wrong, and one of the things that stuck with me is that in your mind, you are right 99.9% of the time. And I'm not even exaggerating. It might be more nines after that point. In your mind, you are always right. There is one exception, and it's that split second when you find out you're wrong. Right? But as soon as that split second is passed, you're right again. Because now you know you were wrong. Right? So in hindsight, you know you were wrong in hindsight. But honestly, that split second is the only time in your life, in your own head, when you're wrong. Every other time, right. Of course, it makes sense, because as soon as I find the information that corrects my thinking, it corrects my thinking. But our brain is used to continually being correct on every count. Okay, and then we go take that and apply it to other people, and of course, we're totally misguided. And we underestimate how our flaws inhibit our judgment. Right? We're correct 99.99% of the time. How could I be wrong in knowing what's your problem? Okay. I can see what's your problem. It's perfectly clear to me. That's our automatic way of thinking. And Jesus says, not true, and we're going to underestimate it. We resist fixing ourselves before trying to fix other people. Right? So much harder to fix ourselves than to fix other people. So we'd rather do the easy job first. Right, the helpful sort of manager job, tell everyone else how they should do things, and the actual doing of things we prefer to postpone. And we presume others want our judgment. We think they want our opinion. Okay, it's usually if people want your opinion, they will actually ask you for it. Okay, and if we want constructive feedback, we should go out and ask for it, so that we're not dogs and pigs, right? But wandering around giving unsolicited opinions is a recipe for conflict. And so we have to decide, who are we? Are we a lamb, are we a pig, or are we a dog? Now, to judge or to judge not, that is the question. It's a little more complicated, as we said at the start, than saying judge not. There are a number of passages in the Bible that show us that we do actually have to judge in certain circumstances. It's an unavoidable responsibility of a community. And so let's look at some of those. If I get you to turn up Revelation chapter 2. This actually comes up in three of the letters to the seven churches, but we'll only read two of them. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14. "But I have a few things against you, because you have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. Clearly, in this ecclesia, they were not judging at a time where they should have been judging. A judgment call should have been made, an action should have been taken, and the fact that they did not have the courage to do so is held against them. And this comes back to motives. Why are you judging not? If you're judging not because you have no courage, that's actually not very scriptural. Verse 20, but I have this against you, that you tolerate the woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, and she teaches and leads my bondservants astray, so that they commit acts of immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols. Tolerating intolerable behavior is not righteous. Okay? So there is a time where a judgment needs to be made. Now, if we can turn to 1 Corinthians 5, we'll look at two verses in 1 Corinthians 5 and in 1 Corinthians 6. Verses 12 and 13 of 1 Corinthians 5. What have I to do with judging outsiders? So that's interesting for a start. What have I to do with judging outsiders? Already there's a whole segment of society that we're kind of disqualified from judging. If they're not in this room, they're not your business. Right? We shouldn't be like those groups that go out there and picket different things and sort of cast judgment on people. We're not about judging the people out there at all. Okay, but the inverse shows up. Do you not judge those who are within the church? Those of us who have signed up to be here have made a certain agreement. We've made a public statement that we're on a certain path. And that is volunteering to get feedback at a certain level. Right? That's part of our journey, is to walk together and to hear from each other. Those who are outside, God judges, verse 13, remove the wicked man from among yourselves. There are circumstances where you need to remove wicked people from a community. These verses against judgment do not eliminate that difficult situation. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 3 to 5. Do you not know that we will judge angels? How much more matters of this life? It's assumed in the kingdom, part of our job is going to be judges. You should be able to handle certain kinds of judgment calls within your ecclesia today. If you can't handle the basic things, you've got a developmental problem within your ecclesia. In this case, they're going to court to settle disputes between brethren. And he's saying that kind of judgment should be able to be handled internally. You should have enough wisdom within your community and respect for each other that you say, I have a problem with you, my brother. Let's go to this third party and get some mediation and figure out how to move forward. You should be able to do that within our community. We should be able to have judgments like that, and we should be able to respect them. But then we have Romans 14, verses 3 to 4. The one who eats is not to regard with contempt the one who does not eat. And the one who does not eat is not to judge the one who eats, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge the servant of another? Who are you? So this is challenging qualifications for judgment, right? Jesus did a lot of that. What are your qualifications, actually, to render an opinion on this case? And in this case, you know, Paul is saying, this person who is in your ecclesia is actually God's servant. He's not your servant. And God is going to evaluate the quality of his work, not you. That's not your primary responsibility, to evaluate whether his work is up to snuff or not. In verse 10 to 13, but you, why do you judge your brother? Or you again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? For we all stand before the judgment seat of God. Okay, this is back to what we were reading in Matthew 5 and 6. We all will stand before the judgment seat of God. You've got to understand your own fallibility when you approach these situations. Right? We all fall short. None of us can fulfill that seventh commandment that Christ gave of being perfect. So verse 12, So then each of us will give account to himself to God. Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. And there's a similar passage in James chapter 4. We'll skip that one over, but you can look it up later. James chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. So we've got to be super careful when we assess our qualifications to judge. The cases need to be extreme. If we look at the cases where judgment is called for, they're pretty extreme cases. The smaller items, it seems to be just don't go there. Unless somebody is asking for your opinion, don't go there. Right? So, what do we do? How do we determine our minimum standards of behavior? You know, a community that doesn't stand for anything is a community that stands for nothing. So we do have to draw lines somewhere. So what principle should we use when deciding how to draw our lines? And for that, I think we should go to Matthew chapter 13. And we'll read verses 24 to 30. And he presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. For while men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares also among the wheat and went away. And when the wheat sprang up and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. And the slaves of the landowner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' And the slave said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' And he said, 'No, lest while you are gathering up the tares, you may root up the wheat also. Allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares, bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" I think this is a profound parable that challenges some of the ways that we usually operate. And what it's saying is, do we have tares in our community? That a healthy and proper church of God must have tares. Okay? This is the field. If your community doesn't have tares, you have been excessive in your weeding. And the expectation is that that distinction, the finer distinctions, are postponed to the reapers. It's the reaper's job to deal with the tares. It's actually not our job. And that we should be comfortable to have a community that has a certain percentage of people who are not going to be in the kingdom of God. You should be able to sit there on Sunday morning and go, yeah, there's probably, I don't know, 10%, 15% of the people here Sunday morning that are not going to be in the kingdom of God, and this is an acceptable way for our community to operate. Because if we try to get to where the people here on a Sunday morning are only those who we know for sure are going to be in the kingdom, then we've gone too far. And our qualifications aren't good enough to make those fine distinctions. We just don't have good enough eyesight. We just don't have good enough care. We don't have enough information about what's really going on to make any of the finer distinctions. So, can our community withstand tares? How do we build a community that accepts a certain amount, percentage of tares? What do we tell our young people in terms of the messages that they're going to hear in our community? Do you just take whatever anybody says and accept it as fact? Or do you examine it more closely? Because you know what? Not everybody in our community has it all figured out yet. And we've got to kind of work together. There's a diversity of opinions, and not all of them are right. And that's okay. Like, that's the surprising part. Just say, there's a diversity of opinions. Some of them are clearly wrong. And that's okay. Because we're going to let God sort it out at the end. And it doesn't mean that we don't have a limit, that we don't have a criteria in our community for what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. It doesn't mean you don't stand up for what is right and what you believe is right. Absolutely. You know, we think this is the way things should be, or we think this is what this principle means. It doesn't mean stopping any of that, but there is a gray area that surrounds the certainty of who's going to be in the kingdom and the certainty of who isn't. There is a gray area, and I propose it's a pretty big gray area. And what Jesus is saying is you have to draw a line, but you got to draw the line outside of the gray. Not inside of the gray, but outside. And the consequence of that is there's going to be some questionable characters inside. And if your community doesn't have questionable characters inside, you're actually running it wrong. It's not about purity in the ultimate sense. We're not trying to make the absolute purest church. Now, God's going to take care of that on Judgment Day, right? We're trying to become ourselves the absolute purest that we can and help as many people as we can along the way, but there's going to be gray areas, and we have to be able to tolerate them. That our primary job in God's field is fertilizing, not weeding. Okay, we're trying to help everybody grow, and the weeding we should leave to God, except, of course, in the extreme cases that we've talked about. Okay, I probably need to do a lightning trip through the rest of the sections of this chapter. We have the ask and it shall be given to you, which is interesting. We're talking about the dogs, right? The dogs and the swine who don't want information. They don't want to hear it. And the next section, Jesus says, ask and it shall be given to you. We should be the kind of people that do go out there and try to actively find new information on how to be better people. Seek and you shall find. Maybe we'll end with this section. If you can look up John chapter 1, I find this such a heartwarming section. John chapter 1. And it's a section where Jesus is gathering his disciples. And the principle here is that our religion and our faith should be one of proactivity, of asking, seeking, finding, going out there and doing something. It's not about just sitting there and waiting for everything to happen. And starting at verse 35, I want you to notice certain words and phrases. Hearing and following, coming and seeing, seeking and finding. Okay, so think of those kinds of phrases. Verse 35. Again, the next day, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked upon Jesus as he walked, and he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. So they obtained information, and they acted on it. And Jesus turned and saw them following, and said to them, "What do you seek?" These are seekers. These are men who are already looking for something. And they said to him, "Rabbi," which translated means teacher, "where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. And one of the two who heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. And he found first his own brother, Simon, and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which translated means Christ. He brought him to Jesus. And Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated Peter. And the next day, he purposed to go into Galilee, and he found Philip. And Jesus said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said to him, "Come and see." And Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." So the key thing that comes out of this is the people that are attracted to Jesus are people who are looking and who are willing to go and seek and try to find. And if we try to find, you will. This is Deuteronomy 4:29. You will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him. If you search for him with all your heart and all your soul, for the Lord your God is a merciful God. God isn't trying to make things difficult for you. He isn't trying to hide things from you. He isn't trying to make it complicated. The complication comes from us and our blurry vision. The complication comes from us and our laziness, of wanting to just sit there and having life happen to us. It doesn't work that way. Right? This is the pearl of great price, which when a man found it, he went and sold all that he had, and he bought that field. Right? This is a message of taking action and changing your life.